Hi, welcome to Deep Into Sleep podcast. We explore sleep, brain, and the body from both scientific and human perspectives. I'm your host, Dr. Yi Shan, a clinical psychologist in behavioral sleep medicine. Today, our guest is special. His name is Dr. Kendall Stewart, a former skull-based surgeon who, over the past two decades, has taken a very different path into functional medicine, genetics, neuroimmune health, and precision nutrition. Dr. Stewart has worked with thousands of patients around the world, from children on the autism spectrum to adults struggling with sleep. His work focuses on one core question: what is actually happening inside of our nerve system? And how can we use objective data to guide our healing process? You may already know Dr. Stewart from his podcast, Coffee with Dr. Stewart. And today, we dive deep into topics that matter to anyone struggling with sleep: neurotransmitter balance, genetics, inflammation, why sleep hygiene alone sometimes is not enough, and how personalized biology can make psychological and behavioral treatment much more effective. If you ever felt that sleep advice was too generic, or that your brain just won't shut off, no matter how hard you try, this conversation is for you. Let's dive in. Hello, Dr. Stewart. Welcome to Deep Into Sleep podcast.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with your work. You are working in the genetic field, and you do a lot of great work related to neurological pathways and to understand, I think, a lot of cognitive issues, sleep issues from very different angle. So we are very excited to have you today to help us understand sleep, understand a lot of cognitive function issues from your specialty.
Sure. Well, I'd love to talk about it. I can tell you as a doctor who's began as a surgeon, I'm not operating too much anymore because I'm just so busy doing other things. But the one thing surgeons don't like to do is guess. And so I was never trained to guess, and even though my background is in ENT, and in particular in what we call neuroimmune syndromes, which are syndromes related to the immune system's effect on the nervous system, we just wanted some objective data so that we could actually see the problem. So, give you an example, if somebody's in pain, how am I supposed to know they're in pain? It's because they tell me, and the problem, if I don't believe them, then I don't have any way to objectively prove it. Well, we decided that we would start using diagnostic tests to actually see inflammation in the system. And so you would assume if you saw inflammation in the nervous system and it was affecting the pain nerves, that that patient was indeed having pain. Oh, that wow. Essentially led us to use different diagnostic tests that we use typically in ENT. We were using things like special tests of the ear called an otoacoustic emission. We were using reflexes like ocular reflexes and many things we did for people who were dizzy and had vertigo. And we got kind of dragged into the arena of autism, because the problem with autism is many of those kids' brains don't work well, not because the brain's problematic, but because the sensory systems that were feeding the brain were not quite very stable, and they would fluctuate. And so what happened is we realized that we could see inflammation in these systems, and we had a very great desire to essentially improve the overall situation of that child. Now, the nice thing about autism that helped us was that those kids don't like to take too many things, so we had to be very specific in what we would be able to give. So eventually that led us to biomarkers and genetics and nutrigenomics, which is a field of genetics that has to do with nutritional elements and replenishing the body for missing conversions of vitamins, nutritional elements, how cells function from mitochondria and other things became kind of popular in about 2015. And in 2016, we decided to open our own lab. And we developed a lab. I parsed through about 10,000 genes and found about 120 that we could use effectively to help people create a better health environment in their body. And the wonderful thing about genetics is when you look at it, you know exactly what you need and you know exactly what you don't need, so you don't waste your money and your time. And right. Part of nutrigenomics was us actually looking at neurotransmitter function, in particular, how fast neurotransmitters are made, but also how fast they're cleared. Because when you deal with neurotransmitters, what most people don't really understand is it's not the quantity of the neurotransmitter that the brain needs. What it needs is a proper ratio and balance to the neurotransmitters. And it also needs an ability when the neurotransmitter crosses the blood, the synaptic cleft, and hits the receptor, it's important how fast that neurotransmitter is removed so we can use another neurotransmitter to signal something else. So we started looking at the classic neurotransmitters and their removal that most people would know, like the COMT or the MAO A and B. We were looking at GAD1, which converts GABA from glutamate, which has a huge role in sleep. And we just started expanding this whole realm. So when we deal with sleep, sleep initiation is one thing, sleep processing is another. And so genetically, we can break it down to tell how we can assist the patient in maximizing their ability to not only initiate sleep, but stay asleep and get quality sleep. And so, yeah. As you know, because you've been doing this a long time, sleep is very complex.
Yes.
From a neurotransmitter standpoint. And in fact, we're still looking at some new things. Galanin plays a big role in sleep. Most people haven't heard of that specific protein. It's a neuropeptide that plays a big role in sleep initiation. And we found out some of those receptors are modulated and people don't tend to shut their brain off very well. We're able to look at the glutamate GABA balance, because GABA initiates sleep and helps us calm our nervous system. We also look at adenosine receptors, and we also we're kind of diving into melatonin receptors too. So all four of those play a big role in being abnormal in people who have trouble with sleep initiation and sleep maintenance.
Yeah, I really like your philosophy and the direction that you want to be sure. You want to use data to guide the treatment, which is very important. As a psychologist, a lot of time when we treat patients, we gonna have to take what they say and try to judge right. And try to understand, right, how you're feeling. And I also right. know now clinically, there are certain questions about, is this really a suffering or symptom you're experiencing, or it's just in your head? How much
right.
it is psychological, how much it is really medical?
Correct. And I can tell you that, you know, being a psychologist, that those are intertwined. And obviously, the psychological state of the brain can modify the effect through its neuroplasticity. But what we're trying to do is make sure that if we can get the person to do proper sleep hygiene, like go to bed at the right time, you know, do all the right things to get the brain prepared, that the brain actually has the sleep initiator balance that allows mm-hmm. them to shut the brain off and go through quality sleep. The other thing is that a lot of people forget that initiating sleep is one thing, but once you get through the first couple of cycles of deep sleep and you get more into the REM types of sleep, dopamine plays a big role in that. And so people who have mutations in the methylation cycle where they can't convert folate to methylfolate very well, they don't make dopamine and serotonin very well. And so by simply adding a vitamin, many times we will help the sleep architecture because we're able to modify the patient to make the things that they need more effectively.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I do want to know, after you gather the data, you understand how all this our neurotransmitters working, how do you really translate those data into treatment?
So here's the deal. Many people have gotten 23andMe or Ancestry, and you try taking that to a doctor, you're going to find out the doctor doesn't have the time nor the inclination, and maybe not the experience. So my background is in biochemistry and cell biology also.
Wow.
So what we decided to do in our companies, and so I built GX Sciences, which is now Phagron Genetics, which was bought by a large Belgian company. And we have another company called Extending Me, which is a longevity company. We're looking at Alzheimer's and dementias and other things from a genetic standpoint, how we can interrupt the cycle. But what we actually wound up doing, and I felt it was important, was if we had a genetic abnormality, we had to have a solution. And the problem with chemistry is the body really needs recipes. I like to say God makes recipes. He doesn't make one thing do one thing. So kind of imagine how many things you can make with sugar, and you'll know that there's an endless amount, but how many can you make with sugar alone? And there's just not much you can do. And so neurotransmitters are very much that way. You have to have a recipe. And I feel like it was important for me as a chemist to know the recipe, because the ratio is important.
Right.
And so what we found wound up doing was finding the genetic polymorphism or mutation, and then basically building a supplement or utilizing a prescription medicine that would actually benefit that specific genetic. So the solution's what's really important. And that's where everything kind of took off for us, because it's one thing for a doctor to go through. I mean, if you bring me 10,000 genes, I could probably parse through them. It's going to take me a long time. But if I have enough where I can focus on what's going on in relation to your symptoms and have a simple solution for you that's already put together. And when you build supplements, we kind of changed the landscape of supplements. When I came on the scene of building supplements in 2007, it was kind of one bottle for one thing. And so the problem was, to make that recipe, you would have to have 3 or 4 or 5 bottles. Now, what it turns out is, when you build supplements, the packaging is a lot of the expense. And absorption and delivery and all those things are important. So we wound up what I call compressing. We went to a compression model. I put everything that belonged together in a single bottle so we could lessen the number of bottles that people were taking. And it turned out it was very successful for men, because men are terrible patients. Men do not like to take very many things.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I have a rule: you never give a man more than 4 to 5 things to do, or he'll forget all of them. Women, on the other hand, are very compliant. Women tend to be very compliant. But what we want to do is control cost, know that we need something so that we're not wasting our money and our time, and basically provide the body what it needs to maximize its ability for it to compensate for whatever weakness is there. And that's pretty much how we approached it.
Wow. Are you able to individualize this?
This is precision.
Wow.
Yes, it is absolutely precision. And that's the foundation of it. What really matters, if you come to see me, is what's wrong with you. You could care less what's wrong with some. I mean, you can be happy for them that it may have worked for them, but you want to know, is it going to work for me or my family or my child? And that's what ultimately we're after. We're after precision medicine for the individual.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah, feels like that's the way to go. Everyone's so different. And in my podcast, I always say sleep is such an individualized thing, right?
Oh,
not everyone
absolutely
needs the same thing, right? If you just buy over-the-counter melatonin, for example, it does not work for everyone. And not everyone really needs that to help them sleep.
That's correct. And so what we would do is we would look at the melatonin receptors. Mm-hmm. And if you had a mutation where your melatonin receptor tended to be weak, we would recommend a little bit higher levels of melatonin. And in people who's not, if they wanted to try it, they would try a lower level. So it's not just that the receptor doesn't work. It's just who has sensitive receptors, who doesn't. What are the ratios? And the biggest one that we run across the most is what we call a GAD1 mutation. It's glutamic acid decarboxylase. And this converts glutamate to GABA. And so it is not completely scientific, but I like to say glutamate's the most plentiful chemical in our brain, and it's responsible for wakefulness. And it's kind of like MSG, okay? And we're supposed to take, I always say 40% of that glutamate and convert it to GABA, which is a calming agent. And so that's not completely scientific because different parts of the brain, there are different conversion rates. But the problem is if that is weak, then you may only convert 20% of GABA. So you're very GABA deficient. And so your glutamate is overzealous. Now, it doesn't mean we need to give GABA. What we need to do is calm the glutamate. Mm-hmm. So this is things like magnesium. Some people take benzodiazepines, alcohol. Those are the things that affect the glutamate receptor. And so that's why people self-medicate with alcohol, magnesium, zinc, and other things, because the glutamate receptor responds to all of those different substances. Now, I'm not endorsing alcohol as a sleep initiator, because eventually it backfires on you, but that's why people go to that. And so I feel like as a doctor, nobody wants to have to use alcohol, but if I can't help them, they're going to use the thing that they can find. And so what I need to be able to do is show them exactly how we can help that receptor calm. And we'll be much more efficient at not having them become dependent.
Yeah, I love that. It's really helped them to find an alternative, healthy alternative, but actually works possibly better with less side effects. And kind of like while you're talking, I'm imagining your feet are either on the gas pedal or on the brake pedal, right? You feel like I have to feel gas, keep on going. Right. But maybe that's the wrong direction. Maybe you have enough power and gas there. You just need other things. You need to step on the brake a little bit on certain things. So it's really a subtle balance for everyone.
Well, in sleep, you know, one of the biggest problems we have is that, so in the brain, you know, we have stimulants, essentially dopamine, acetylcholine, glutamate, serotonin to a certain degree in some areas. But what happens is if we get sleepy at night and we fight through that circadian rhythm type of process for about 15 or 20 minutes, we will get another cortisol spike. And then we'll have a flood of those stimulant neurotransmitters, and we just bought another 2 hours of being awake. And I don't have to tell you how easy it is to fight through 15 minutes with your phone or with your computer. Yeah. You understand? And even with light. And so obviously we have the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the light sensor in our brain. And so the biggest thing that I see is, besides genetic weaknesses for people who have chronic sleep issues, is they also tend to have poor sleep hygiene. They don't tend to go to sleep when their body's sleepy. Mm-hmm. And that's why when you're stressed and you got projects due at work and you're trying to keep your mind busy, you fight through that little 15 to 20 minute window. And most people don't realize it'll take about 2 hours for that cortisol to go back down for you to get another window. And so, I mean, sleep is a tough animal. It really is. And then obviously you can get into all the other, you know, obstructive apnea and all the other sleep disorders. But from a general perspective, if you don't have that kind of condition, a lot of it's just problems genetically that you inherited with your neurotransmitter balance.
So I have a question. When I work with insomnia patients, for example, we do a lot of cognitive work to help to help them learn how to calm their mind, how to talk to themselves, right? How to perceive sleep differently. Sometimes that can reduce sleep anxiety. And from your approach, sounds like you more directly work in the neurons, neural system. And
well, so if I get the neurotransmitters right, your method will work better. Remember that many of these people need therapeutic intervention, but you can be the greatest therapist in the world. And if I don't hand you a patient that's able to adapt to that therapy, then you're not going to be successful.
Right.
So, for instance, neurofeedback, which is very common, and that's basically what you're talking about, very dopamine dependent. So if I have a person who can't make enough dopamine because they're methylfolate deficient, if I can get some methylfolate in them for 6 weeks and then you go to neurofeedback, you're going to get a much better effect. I helped one of my friends get his PhD in psychotherapy. And we basically looked at acoustic reflexes, which are reflexes that are highly dopaminergic and acetylcholine based. And we were able to predict outcomes with biofeedback.
Wow.
So in general, we know that my job for you, I'm not saying people don't need therapy when they come see me, but my job is to prepare them nutritionally to make them whole so that that therapy can be the most effective.
Yeah.
And that's true for everything. That's true for kids with autism. That's true for physical therapy, occupational therapy, psychotherapy, all the therapies. And it's just something a lot of people don't think about. Preparing the person makes a lot of sense.
Right. I noticed that in my treatment, not from this angle, but with psychiatrists. We work with psychiatrists. Sometimes we do notice certain patients are not quite ready for therapy. They just cannot take the information in, or they could not really take action plans. So sometimes they do need medication to help. Adjust their nerve system. When they are more ready, therapy become more efficient. Sounds like what you're talking about is in this similar idea, how to combine these two to work together.
Correct. So if we're going to talk about medications, I actually find out that SNRIs, which can address several of the neurotransmitters at first, and SNRIs, we have specific neurotransmitters that certain SNRIs are more potent in. So you can actually look at them and tell which neurotransmitter it's more specific for. So if I'm going to use a medication, that's what I'll use. But if I can naturally enhance it, nobody wants to take a medicine for the rest of their life.
Right.
So, you know, for me, medicine is very important in critical situations, in emergencies. But if I can also then slide under that and make them nutritionally whole, eventually we may be able to the point where we can back off, reduce, because all psychiatric medicines, dose specificity defines side effects in almost every one of them. So the lower the dose or even being off of it makes people feel more comfortable. That does not mean they're not needed. It just means that if we can get something back into them that's missing, we may be able to not need it. So.
Yeah. Your work touch on a lot of very difficult medical issues. Autism is something we haven't fully figured out. And I think there's a lot of work in that and many other medical conditions. So I'm just curious, in your data, in your working process, what you notice, like your method, your company works best for, or it's just generally you see a
well,
place
it
to
works
contribute?
Generally. So, you know, I've seen about 2,500 children with autism in my career, beginning in about 2000. And basically, I don't like the spectrum because when you see a nonverbal autistic child, that's not the same as ADD, and you don't approach it the same, even though they're on the spectrum. So I'll define the nonverbal or poor verbal socially significantly delayed children is what I call true autism. Okay. Now, in that facet, we know from an autistic standpoint, from genetic tests that we've done on about 1,500 of them, is that we find about four things that are almost a given. Number one, we find trouble with inflammation control. Once inflammation is initiated, they have trouble turning it back off. So by looking at the genetics, we can tell which system is involved, and we're able to use things that are safe long-term and nutritional elements to essentially calm the inflammation, and that makes the child more consistent. We don't have any more good days and bad days. The second thing we find out, 100% of these children have autophagy genes. Autophagy is Latin for self-eating. It won the 2016 Nobel Prize in medicine. And it has to do with us being able to clean debris when the cells are at rest. Not the body at rest, but the cells at rest. The problem with the nervous system, when it gets in trouble, it does not know how to rest. And so it does not clean itself very well. And so if that debris builds up, most of these children will get into insulin resistance. Because remember, children need 3 to 4 times more glucose delivery to their cells than adults because they're trying to grow. And so we do find that to be a big issue. And we use a very specific vitamin called D-chiroinositol, which is a special form of what used to be vitamin B8. But it helps insulin deliver glucose in those children. It's what we call a second messenger. We find out that a lot of these children do have detoxification issues. Their glutathione system is not healthy. And then the biggest thing that's been fairly recent, we find out that their neurotrophic factors, the healing factors of the nervous system, specifically brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and nerve growth factor are mutated in close to 90% of the children, which means they are weak. So whatever initiates the autism, which is usually an inflammatory stimulus of some sort, the biggest problem sometimes is not that you got rid of the inflammation, or the problem is that you don't have strength in the healing. So we have to almost work on two things at once. We have to work on controlling whatever got you there and is keeping you there, but also maximizing the ability to recover. And that's what a lot of people forget. And so we do have a beautiful new peptide from Washington State University. It's called Dihexa, and it actually takes brain-derived neurotrophic factor and nerve growth factor and makes them 5 to 7 times higher.
Oh, wow.
So we've been able, with a simple peptide, to actually significantly improve the healing side, which was really the complex side of autism recovery. Now, the biggest issue is that the children, if you do that methodology, if you came to my office with a child with autism, I would tell you that I'm using repair of those simple processes, I'll have about a 70 to 75% chance of making that child eventually verbal and able to learn and progress socially. But there's 25% of kids that you do all that stuff and nothing happens. And that actually falls into an arena of what we believe is the cell danger response, which is something that was described by Dr. Naveau in a really nice paper back in 2014, where the brain, if it is pushed hard enough or in trouble in enough situation that is severe enough, it will actually shut down into a pseudo-hibernation state where it uncouples the mitochondria. And that is a very elegant paper. It's very hard to read if you're not a cell biologist. But we are working on trying to figure out how to interrupt that cell danger response. And it makes sense. If a cell's working so hard that it's running out of resources and going to die, it might as well shut down into hibernation.
Right.
And it's actually very elegant chemistry, but that's the really severe kids. And sometimes those kids are low muscle tone and floppy, and, you know, so We never expected. We used to biopsy muscles all the time for kids with autism because it looked like mitochondrial disease, but we would never find it. We never in our wildest dreams thought that the mitochondria would actually uncouple. Just, you just wouldn't have thought that. So if we can get it plugged back in, I think we've got a really great chance of helping most of these kids start to recover.
Yeah. Wow. Look forward to the new progress in that.
Yeah. I'm sorry I went so deep, but.
I love that. I hope our audience love that. I feel like even though I don't understand all the detailed process because I'm not in exactly the same field, but just by hearing that, I think gave us a lot of hope. There's something can be done on neurological level to help autism kids.
Well, just remember, like we talked about with your therapy, if you go to the pediatrician or the family practice doctor, I mean, an autistic child is very scary to a doctor. You don't really want to see it. So they'll send them to the therapist, and that's great. And these are great therapists that are really well trained. But if you give them a patient who's having good days and bad days, the therapist is going to be unsuccessful because there's no consistency.
Right.
And so always remember that you got to do something to get what, if you do nothing, you're going to get nothing. So we have to stabilize that child and then take advantage of the therapies. Now, will they need speech therapy and occupational therapy and behavioral therapy? Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, they've got to relearn it. And, and typically we'll find out most of those kids when we get them started will progress about 2 years of development for every year of time. So it's not super rapid. It's just you can get them started and they catch up. But you've got to do something to get that stability to them. And you got to have energy to make all cells work. So,
right. Wow. So I hear very hopeful directions, but I'm just curious how to deliver that eventually. Will that just by observe something orally? Or it's going to involve surgery and other type of intervention?
Yeah, it will not be surgery. It'll be oral or transdermal or injectable. We do know that, well, not to get too complicated, but the purine receptors, which respond to adenosine. So adenosine is used in sleep. So we have this huge group of receptors on the brain, and those are involved in this cell danger response if they're hit too hard. So we are looking at natural things and also some old medicines. I tend to love medicines from the 1970s because they came from plant derivatives. So I'm pretty geeky when it comes to chemistry. I'm one of those guys that can look at something and know where it came from. And it's just something that sticks in my head. But we're looking at some older medicines that have some ability to not hurt any child and may be able to get us to block or affect a change in those most severe of children.
Yeah. I know now we all talk about holistic treatment. And sure. I'm from China, so Asian culture, there's a lot of herbal medicine, right? Even now we have traditional Chinese medicine. So, I feel like I really like you are trying to combine those, think about how to reduce the harm, how to reduce the side effects, because anything man-made chemicals, it's just going to be hard. It's not quite natural, and it's going to lead to something.
Remember that we made a big mistake back in the 80s. Back in the 70s, almost all medicines came from plant derivatives. But then we made a decision that you could not patent anything that was found in nature. And so what they wound up doing was taking these plant derivatives that worked and then changing them biochemically so that they could get a new patent and get their return of investment. So that was a mistake in hindsight, if you ask me, but that's what happened. And in the neurologic field, you know that we don't come up with very many new medicines. We just kind of repurpose and change existing medicines a lot. And so we've got some work to do. We're also learning that a lot of older medicines that were used for a specific purpose back in the 60s, 70s, 80s actually have a whole lot of other benefits that we never just studied. And so we're actually trying to get our hands on that and see where they're beneficial for us. And so I just really like to dive into where they came from, how they were discovered, the great scientists that were behind that. Many of them won Nobel Prizes, and they're just, you know, I didn't create any of this, but I like to think of myself as an awesome assimilator.
Great. Yeah, I really connect back to the nature and connect back to the root of things and try to move from there. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the problem when you're dealing with most of these syndromes, neurologic syndromes, they're not consistent. They're not there all the time. You know what I mean? And it's you're stuck chasing your tail a lot. And then the problem with more elderly type of neurologic diseases is because the nervous system always works harder when it's in trouble. They use more resources, and all nervous system diseases progress because all the cell knows how to do is work harder, and we just work ourselves into a deficit. And so we spend a lot of time trying to slow the brain down medicinally, naturally, and with pharmaceuticals, just so we can catch up sometimes.
Yeah, I do feel, because I work with a lot of patients with anxiety and with sleep disorders, I do feel like a lot of people's brain got trained to keep on doing the plus equation, keep on adding things, keep on going faster, faster, right? Yep. That's the only path. And even psychologically, we try so many different methods like meditation, other things to help us slow down. There are books talk about slowing down is the new power, is the new thing.
Correct.
You use neurological ways as well. So I think we are just going to the wrong direction somehow.
Well, and you're right. And our society takes us there because there's something new to keep stimulating us. But that's the principle in my mind of meditation. You only have a limited number of resources, and that's genetically determined by your ability to absorb, convert, and deliver. And so when the body exceeds that, we really can't put in more because in chemistry, enzymes have what we call a rate limiting step. They can only make as much as they can make. And so if we don't get a hold of the brain and bring it back to a less hyper state, we just won't catch up. And so meditation is a wonderful thing to do that because you're modulating the brain waves, you're slowing the neurons down, and you're basically giving us a chance to catch up nutritionally.
Yeah. Great. So I want to know where the status is for your company, for all this new trend you are talking about. So far, I hear great things, and I'm sure many of the audience possibly are curious if they want to figure out their own data and get some of this individualized treatment. How can they get it?
So there's two ways to do that. First of all, I'm going to tell you, I have a podcast called Coffee with Dr. Stewart. So if you listen to that, you'll get an idea of how we approach things because it's not very typical. It's more of what we've talked about. Mm-hmm. Now, the second thing is if you have a complicated neurological disease, you'd probably want to make an appointment with me and we get those genetics from one of two companies, either Phagron or Extending Me. So just to tell you about something, we have a new Alzheimer's dementia panel genetically coming out in 3 weeks that has 52 genes, not just two genes, 52, to tell us, because we've literally found that there's probably five different biochemical ways to get into a dementia type of issue. And so that tells us what's issue and how we can start to interrupt that process. If you don't have a big problem, then we would like you to go to our newest company, which is called Helix Revolution. And that is basically a direct-to-public. You basically can order a small panel. We have GI panels. We have mood panels. We have cellular energy and methylation panels. And you order that panel, and I shot a bunch of videos of education on how to read it. We have lots of educational materials. And then we built supplements to actually provide you with what's needed when you find out what you're missing. And that way you don't need a doctor to interpret it. And you don't need to spend as much money. And so that's what we know a lot of people will need. So if you're sick, go to the doctor. If you're not sick, take advantage of just getting a panel and putting it back into you. It's just like going and putting gas in your car and making sure your washer fluid's full. And once we replenish that, people just feel better. And the nice thing about it is we don't have to prove it, because if they ever stop it, it's pretty evident that, if you don't put gas in your car, it runs out of gas. So this is not guesswork. We always know exactly genetically how you're converting and delivering. So that's what we would encourage.
Okay. Any side effects of any of this?
No. So in the more complicated genetics, we do use prescription medicines. So all prescription medicines have some potential side effects, and they work for some people and they don't for others. So you need to be counseled on that. As far as nutritional supplements themselves, there are typically no side effects. There can be a timing issue. So if you have inflammation in your system, for instance, and we put methylfolate in to help you make more dopamine and serotonin, that also feeds the immune system. So sometimes there's a timing where we have to start one first and then go to something else. But from a standpoint of supplements, I'd like you to think about a soup. What can you put in soup? And the answer is anything. Now, it may not taste great, but you can put it in there. And that's kind of what supplements are. These are bioidentical, natural things that are in nature and are designed to be in your body.
Okay, great. Yeah, a lot of great resources. And I will also add some of the resources in the show note. So whoever watching and listening can click through and read more and find the website. Also, if you have the papers, any of the papers, feel free to give me the link. I can also put them in the website just in case, you know, any of our audience want to read the paper.
Sure.
Yeah. Any last wisdom you want to share? Oh, sorry. Yeah.
You know, no, you don't need to apologize ever. So my biggest wisdom is that as a physician or a professional, just like you, you and I both know that having people that ultimately change their life and feel better and do well makes us very happy. And it gives us a lot of satisfaction. And so I certainly just want this to be accessible to more people. I mean, not just my patients, because I'm only, even though I've trained many, many hundreds of doctors, that's just a limited exposure. So I'd like it to be kind of more, instead of just going to the store and buying what you think is in what you need, I want you to go and spend your money on things you know you need. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, I think you're going to realize that supplements do play a big role. Nutrition plays a big role. Diet plays a big role. Exercise plays a big role. And so all we're interested in doing is being proactive and getting everybody healthy, both mentally and physically. So,
yeah, I love that. Knowing what you actually need is so important.
And knowing what you don't need also. Mm. So that's what's also important, because I can tell you if you don't need it, you're just, you know, you're just making expensive urine. So,
yes. And sometimes if you have too much of something in your system that you don't need, it can also cause some trouble to you.
Correct. That is correct. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
And so what we're really interested in, just for one last caveat, blood is great, but it's just the delivery system. We're interested in what's in the cell. Because what you'll find out is many times what's high in the blood is low in the cell because it can't get into the cell.
That's a good
point. So, for instance, if you have a folic acid that's super high, I can tell you that the folic acid in the cell is not high, it's low, because it can't transport. So blood can be confusing, and it's kind of been the gold standard, but we're trying to change that a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that. I think the science is always moving forward. We now Correct. Only do the blood test, right? We possibly are missing something. And I know genetic tests are getting more and more popular for other things. But eventually, hopefully, they're going to be combined way to really be able to generalize to our daily healthcare system.
Right. And the problem is, though, is genetics are hard. You got to know a lot about chemistry. And so a lot of times doctors, not purposeful, but they might read them wrong. They may not be familiar with them. And so we try to make it a simplified, streamlined process where we just let the test actually interpret it for you and tell you what you need.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Stewart. All these are exciting, and look forward to reading some of the papers and put all the resources together for more people. Thank you for your time. This is very helpful to know.
As we wrap up today's conversation, I want to highlight one key message from Dr. Stewart's work. Sleep is not just about willpower, discipline, or doing more. Very, very often, it's actually about balance. In neurotransmitters, inflammation, genetics, and the nerve system's ability to slow down and recover. What I especially appreciate about this conversation is how clearly it shows that psychological work and biological support are not opposites. They work best together. When the brain is better supported, therapy actually works better. When our nerve system is calmer, sleep comes more naturally. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Stewart's work, go to his podcast, Coffee with Dr. Stewart, or the genetic and functional medicine resources we discussed in this episode. You will find all the links in the show notes. If this episode resonated with you, I encourage you to share it with someone who struggles with sleep, anxiety, or chronic fatigue. You never know who might need this perspective. Thank you for listening to Deep Into Sleep podcast. Please take care of your mind, your body, and most importantly, your rest. I hope you sleep well and rest well. I will see you in the next episode. Bye.
Sleep is an individual thing. We all sleep differently, and there is so much we can do to improve sleep quality. Keep hope and carry on. This podcast is for general informational purpose only and does not include the practice of medicine or other health professional services. Usage of the information we share is at the listener's own risk, and our content does not intend to be a substitute for any medical and professional services, diagnoses, and treatment. Please seek professional health services as needed.